Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. So, we survived the match. You know, as much as I wanted to say that I'm not going to pay, I'm not going to watch, there I was, glued to the set on Friday afternoon. Honestly, I can't say what I disliked more, the shabby golf or the shabby presentation. In my opinion, it was bad TV all the way around. Now, that being said, I do like some of the things they tried to incorporate, the social media interaction, the gambling aspects. And I think that these sorts of matches are here to stay, just some improvement needed. We'll talk all things match with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Also, what's it like to be in charge of setting up a golf course to host a major championship? Matthew Wharton is the course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club, who hosted the first round of the USGA's mid-end this summer, and we'll pick his brain on that very subject. Also, we'll wrap things up with Ryan Ballingy of thegolfnewsnet.com and his 10 predictive questions for the upcoming season. But we begin with Ron Green Jr. So when you got up this morning and it was about 25 degrees, did the thought cross your mind of, you know, maybe I should have said yes to the Global Golf Post or going down to the Bahamas?
Oh, it crossed my mind before today.
I thought about you. I was like, man, Ron's probably going, I've had that gig before. That weather was awful nice.
Yeah, I just a minute ago was telling my bride, I said, I think next year we're going and staying in a $300 a night hotel down there.
Absolutely.
Even though you have to put up $200 for a work permit to go down there to cover the thing.
Well, Ron, let's talk post Thanksgiving and the golf world and the match. Before I give you my opinions, what was your overall impression of what went down?
Well, I'm glad I'm not the person who has to explain why none of the pay per view thing worked.
Well, here's what I'm mad about: everybody else got a refund except we DirecTV people.
Well, I think we Spectrum people are getting one. They had sent me a nice package in advance promoting the thing, and I had a little code to watch on my laptop, but we had a bunch of people over, so we got it anyway. But, you know, I mean, I think it's an interesting concept. I think there's some merit to what they're trying to do. I think this fell a little on the flat side of what they wanted it to be. I think going forward, you could take what they did, and if you want to continue trying to do these things, you take the good parts and eliminate the slower parts. I think these are ideas I've already heard other people throw around. You might want to put them in carts because, quite honestly, as we all know, when you play golf and you're walking from shot to shot, there's a lot of time between shots. And I think trying to fill that time, they wound up with a group of guys who trying to talk over players and didn't know when the players were going to be jabbering back and forth. And obviously there wasn't as much of that as you thought, but I think quicken the pace and, you know, make them play for something that matters. I mean, I heard somebody on one of the radio shows says, here's the deal, forget the money because we don't pay attention to the money anyway. You could tell the money, whatever agreement they had struck beforehand on how the money would be split. I don't think the money was a factor to them at all. But now, as somebody said, what if the loser on one of those side bets had to caddy in a pro-am for the other guy? Something like that. You know, something, put some real skin in it.
Oh, yeah. Use of Tiger Woods' plane for a week.
Well, Phil's plane's just as big as Tiger's, I think. So,
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking dead aim. Yeah, you brought up a couple of things. Number one, I think this sort of thing is here to stay. I think there is some merit to what they were doing. Like you, I thought there were some tweaks. I hadn't thought about the carts thing. That's a great idea. The other component that I know they were really trying to fit in, and I don't think they anticipated as much social media interaction from other pros and other celebrities as they got, is it would have been nice if instead of Charles Barkley sitting, you know, behind a desk going over these things, if you would have had like a social media correspondent for each player with each player on the course, and they could respond in real time to what was being said. I thought that might have been interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I was not on social media when it was happening. But, you know, I think all those things, you know, the interactivity of it is sort of critical. I'm not sure that the two-man thing, the thing I like best is if you say, okay, in a perfect world, if you're going to do it again next year, putting Phil and Tiger against Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas, the one a lot of people try to, that'd be a good one. That would be fun. I think people would like that. And I think that would engage you. I think, you know, for all the chatting that Phil has, I think when you get involved in that and the walking and everything, I think it just closed down some of that. That's why I think if you could get them quicker to shots and everything, and you know, as much as Phil likes to sort of instigate things, I think, you know, that's not Tiger's natural personality. I mean, he's more subtle, more low-key, and more sort of self-contained. And, I don't think that's, you know, not what he's terribly comfortable in, and he's not really going to manufacture a lot of that. So, I mean, it was fine. I think it told me something when they were at the end and I went in and did something else and didn't even watch the playoff. Because, of course, when you get 12 people over for dinner and they're sort of waiting, you kind of get distracted for that. But, you know, I think who won and lost in that really didn't matter. But I think it's great that they got the extra holes in. I don't know if I would have done it quite that way. It would have been fine had they ended it with a draw, but anyway, live and learn.
Yeah, going into it when they were hyping all of the back and forth between the two, the one thing that struck me is, what, is Tiger going to become a different person? That isn't who Tiger Woods is. And at the end of the day, you know, four or five holes into it, all of a sudden those two guys were playing golf again. Phil was up chatting with his brother, and Tiger was being Tiger, basically saying nothing. It's who they were, and if a main component was going to be these two guys jabbering, then someone was sold a bill of goods, because that wasn't going to happen. Now, like you said, if you team Tiger up with Phil, and you've got sort of a Lucy and Ethel thing going, while you've got another team going, I think that's a whole different ball game in terms of sociability and interaction between the two teams. But if, you know, people don't just change their spots on command.
No, I mean, I think, you know, part of what you're trying to get is get to the real personality of who they are. And I think, you know, in some ways, it may not have been what you wanted, but you got what you asked for in some ways. And so, yeah, I mean, I think Tiger's really good at little digs and everything, but he's not going to carry on a monologue. You know, he's not going to just, you know, stop and say, hey, yo, 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 let's do this. But, you know, I think the side bets, they kind of got lost in some ways. I think if you got them, you know, in a bunker and you go, okay, I got you for 50,000 up and down from here or something like that right then. It's easy to play with other people's money like that, I think.
Ron, you bring up money, and this was the other thing that they hammered a lot, but I think a lot was lost in translation on a ton of people. I think a big component of this was the gambling, and with it being in Vegas, you had a lot of numbers and pluses and minuses being thrown around without a whole lot of explanation. Do you think that was something that's here to stay? That's a component of this that they want? Or was that just a Vegas thing? And if it is here to stay, don't you need to have somebody, you know, on site to explain what's being said and what's being talked about?
Yeah. You know, the side bets didn't really interest me that much. I mean, I guess maybe they're, you know, a little bit of interest, but not, I thought it would have been more than that. I thought, oh, God, here we go. We're going to do this or that. It didn't quite catch me the way I think they wanted it to be. Yeah, and, you know, when they start doing like plus 180 or minus 150 and all that stuff, they sort of lose me because I'm terrible with numbers. And there's a reason they call it gambling. And for me, it's not even gambling because I'm guaranteed to lose whatever I'm doing if it involves numbers. But, you know, I think having somebody who can tell you what's going on, I think while that might add a voice, I think there was a lot of voices could be subtracted. Obviously, the Capital One thing, having Samuel L. Jackson and Charles Barkley, who were part of those commercials and everything, that was part of it. I think, you know, though I was in and out of it, I think Peter Jacobson got criticized for maybe talking a little too much when we want to hear the players. But as I said, the problem is you don't know when the players are going to be talking. So if you're one of those guys trying to provide commentary and you don't want a lot of quiet time while guys are walking 300 yards of their tee shot, you know, I think, again, I think it's something the people who did it will go back and analyze it and see what worked and see what can be improved. And, you know, I mean, it got people talking. I think I would be interested to see the numbers of how many people actually tuned in to watch. I don't know what their projected number was, if it was more, if it was less. But, you know, I mean, I think it was a curiosity thing, which is good. I mean, it was a good thing to have. I'm still amazed that it showed up on the official PGA Tour website as part of the schedule. But, you know, there you go. And I love the fact that, as we heard back when the whole thing started, you know, it was going to be $10 million. So the PGA Tour said, no, it's not, because that's what we play for in the FedEx Cup. So it's going to be $9 million. And, of course, now FedEx Cup will be worth $15 million. So we'll see where the next one goes.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. A couple other things on the match. Two things that came out of it from a commentary standpoint, although, like you said, there was plenty of criticism. I actually love Charles Barkley just being Charles Barkley. I would sit there and watch him, you know, call a Tupperware cookout. I just think he's that entertaining and engaging a personality. And also, I think we may have seen what could be sort of a David Faraday 2.0 with Pat Perez when he decides to hang him up. I think he is extremely entertaining.
He's extremely entertaining, and, you know, having been around him a good bit, he is, I mean, he's not short of opinions. Obviously, he shares them on Sirius XM, on the radio show he does. I think he has to, you know, if he were to ever get a true television gig, he would have to certainly filter himself, because, I mean, he is unfiltered, and it's a little dicey sometimes. You know, if you're quoting him, you might have to edit it a little bit. Because he gets a little salty, but I mean, he's true to himself, and I mean, he's, you know, you always want characters in the game. Well, he's a really intriguing character, and I mean, great for us in the media who want to talk to guys and get insights and thoughts, because he certainly will give them. And Barkley, I think you mentioned it, it's that old thing. If you said, all right, you can invite five people to a dinner party, who would you invite? Well, let's start with Charles Barkley.
Yes.
I mean, from there on, I mean, it doesn't matter who you got, because, right or wrong, he's got an opinion, and it's darn funny and usually pretty insightful.
You know, with the way the season has now been extended for the last several years, we've essentially eliminated one of the things of pro golf that I liked. I liked all the old silly season events. I was a big fan of them. It was an alternative way to watch golf, and really one of the last of the silly season events that survives is Tiger's World Challenge, the Hero World Challenge down in the Bahamas. Of those kind of events, is that pretty well run? Do they have that, you know, pretty well down at this point?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a smooth operation. It helps because, I mean, what do you have, 18 players or something? It's
right.
A lot easier to manage 18 players than 156 or something. It's very self-contained. I mean, the golf course is there's nothing really around the golf course. The sort of interesting part is that you're in the Bahamas near the ocean, but it's not on the water. It's easy to get around. There are no galleries, so to speak. There's a few hundred people, maybe 1,000 there. You know, it's comfortable for the players. The media contingent is really, really limited, and it's they can go out there and play in 3 hours and 45 minutes and be done with it and have a nice afternoon. The weather tends to be good. They stay in great places. And, you know, I know Hero just extended the sponsorship of it, so it's obviously working for them on that end. I mean, I wish I could remember the statistic. We're not as terribly familiar with Hero motorcycles as other parts of the world, but I want to say they have sold enough motorcycles that if you put them end to end, they would circle the globe twice or something like that. I mean, it's a staggering number, and obviously it's an important arrangement Tiger has with them, and it works for Hero. And so I think, you know, it will continue, and I think if you're good enough to be invited to that event, it tells you how good you are, and you want to go play against the best. And yeah, it's a very laid back feeling. When I've been to three of them, I think, and it's just, you know, there's a little bit of that island vibe to it.
You know, you speak of Tiger and this event, and it just occurred to me from the standpoint of what you do for a living. It's a completely different paradigm this year. The last 3 years, 3 years ago, it was you and Tiger in a golf cart. Tiger was in extreme pain. I remember you coming back from that saying, I don't know what's going to happen with this guy. And then the 2 years after that was Tiger trying to make a comeback. This year, I wonder what the big story is down there.
Well, I think as long as he's involved in anything, he's always the big story. I think, he sort of put a bow on this year with his victory at the Tour Championship. Now, he's since obviously played the Ryder Cup. But, I mean, I think, you know, this is – he at least Listom said he hadn't done much since the Ryder Cup. He hadn't done a whole lot of work on his games, just sort of starting getting back in that when he started working for the match. You know, I don't expect him to win down there, but I think he's got as good a chance as anybody. I mean, somebody like – it won't shock me if Justin Rose goes and wins. But I just think – I mean, he's the story, and as we wait for the start of next year, my guess is he won't play Kapalua, even though he's eligible. I hope he does, but you know, we'll be waiting until Torrey Pines to see him tee it up in the latter part of January, I guess. But I mean, I just think the big story already is sort of the projecting into next year, and now that we've seen he can win, now that we've seen him contend in two major championships. I mean, I know the Players' Championship will be the first one, but not that far off till Augusta, and everything will start pointing toward that. And you know, how's Tiger shaping up for Augusta? Because if he's going to win another major, and I think at this point you got to believe he's totally capable of it, I think if you could pick one, that would be the one.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, what's it like to be in charge of setting up a golf course to host a major championship? Matthew Wharton, course superintendent of Carolina Golf Club, takes dead aim at the USGA's Mid-Am, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Matthew Wharton is the course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club and therefore was charged with setting up that course this summer to host the first round of the USGA's Mid-Am Championship. Matthew, my first question is about hosting the U.S. Mid-Am and dealing with the USGA. First off, how long in advance did you know that the event was coming? When did you find out that you would be hosting part of the Mid-Am?
I was actually kind of clued in as early as 2014. Our general manager at the time sort of shared with me that he'd had a conversation with the GM at Charlotte Country Club and that this might happen. And then in April of 2015, we actually had an official site visit by Bill McCarthy, who's the director of the United States Mid-Amateur Championship. And essentially, he was here. He met with me, our club president, a couple other board members, played the golf course. And in essence, it was kind of like a, I guess you'd call it a fact-finding, sightseeing mission on his part. He was just trying to assess, kind of what we could bring to the table as Charlotte was inviting the USGA to conduct the tournament and wanted us to serve as the companion course. And so after that, that kind of got the wheels in motion and then really started to ramp up in 2016 with more site visits and then plannings and preparation.
Now, in terms of suggestions, how long after they finished, after McCarthy finishes his round of golf, he goes back to wherever he is stationed, I guess, wherever he lives, he writes up a report, he makes his assessment. What sort of changes did he suggest, did the USGA suggest? And are they more suggestions or you need to do this?
I would say that he was kind enough to say, you know, look, these are just merely suggestions. It's your golf course. It belongs to you and your membership. And, you're not under any obligation. However, our membership embraced the challenge of co-hosting the event. And all of his suggestions really were just around our mowing patterns. So we narrowed a few fairways. Most of those changes were on one side or the other. For example, it's like, well, let's just bring the right-hand side of this fairway in maybe two more widths. Well, let's bring the left side in on this hole one more width. It was very small and subtle adjustments. The sixth hole was the one difference where that's the only hole where we pinched a little on both sides, and that's our shortest par four on the front.
Right.
Some elevated tee, as you know. Mm-hmm. It's got that big fairway bunker on the right. And so if you were going to lay up of that bunker and leave yourself about 140 to 150 yards in, you had plenty of room. But if you were going to play aggressive off the tee and get a wedge in your hand, the fairway pinched significantly well beyond that bunker. And then with regards to, you know, we've got some closely mown areas around our putting surfaces. His suggestion there was to increase those and expand them, take them farther out. In other words, if the ball was going to roll off the putting surface and trundle down the hill, he wanted it to roll a little farther away.
Oh, good Lord, I haven't seen the changes post-suggestion. I can only imagine that third hole, that green's already elevated and has a roll-off. That had to be a nightmare.
We extended that area behind you. When you were here last, Charlie, you probably remember that shortcut area extended beyond the green and kind of tied into the back tee.
Yes.
We took it farther to the right, past the bunker, almost tied it into the cart path, if you will, Jeez. That little parking area, and swooped it around because there was another tee there. Our back tee was shared with our black markers and then what we call our Ross markers, and then the next tee deck up was our blue markers. And there was some turf maintained at rough height between those two teeing areas. That all got mowed down close.
Okay, so essentially the ball would roll to Coyote Joe's.
Exactly.
Matthew Wharton is the course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club. He's our guest taking Dead Aim, talking a little bit about hosting the U.S. Mid-Am. You talk about bringing in mower heights just one row or one mower pass or two mower passes to bring in fairways. Did you find it somewhat interesting and at times incredible just how much difference that made in the playing of the golf course, just that one mower width or two mower widths?
Believe it or not, it did make a big difference. And I'll give you a prime example. So our seventh hole, those mowing changes, I'll back up just a second, those mowing changes were suggested in 2016, and we made those changes then and went through one whole full season of 2017 with them and then again in 2018. So we kind of played the golf course for two full summers, if you will, with that. With the exception of the seventh hole, we were putting in two new fairway bunkers on the left side. So Mr. McCarthy says, well, I'm not going to make any suggestions on the fairway width here until after I come back next year to see these bunkers, and I'll kind of make a determination. And so once he sees the bunkers, he's like, yeah, Matthew, we still need to pinch this fairway in on the right a little bit. Otherwise, you've got so much room over there that the bunkers will never come into play. And really, what he was trying to accomplish with these alterations was kind of force the player to fit the ball into a particular space, if you will, instead of just being able to just kind of bomb it without any regards to the potential consequences. So we narrowed that fairway in on the right-hand side of the seventh hole, and I'm playing around the golf here with my greens chairman. We would typically play on the day before greens committee meetings, and our committee meetings here are once monthly. And we're playing the seventh hole, and he hits his tee shot, and I hit a tee shot. And, you know, they just look like two good shots down the middle. Don't think anything of it. We're walking, so we throw the clubs on the back, and we just trundle on down the fairway, and we're talking about this and talking about that. And we get out in the middle of the fairway, and we're looking around, and there's only one ball. Mine had gone through the fairway into the rough. It took us a while to took us a while to find it because the line wasn't that great because the rough here was pretty thick this past summer.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's one thing I wanted to ask you about because I had one or two friends that played in the Mid-Am at Carolina. Or at Carolina, and I asked him. I said, "Okay, talk to me the two courses. What stood out to you? You know, the difficulty between Charlotte and Carolina." And each of them did not hesitate. They said the rough at Carolina was as real can get because we had a great summer. If you were a sadistic course superintendent and wanted to grow in your rough, this was the summer to do it. And from what I understand, it was thick and meaty at Carolina.
That's a good way to put it, Charlie. Yes, it was definitely, it was as thick and as dense as I've ever seen it. We did it, you know, it was hot and dry in June and July, but come August, we got some beneficial rainfall and the fertilizer kicked in. And the temperatures were just right. And yes, we grew some pretty thick, gnarly rough here at Carolina.
How fast after the Mid-Am did your membership hand you a lawnmower and say, head out there?
Well, they did want us to mow it down, but we also had the club championship was scheduled. The very next weekend, we had our senior men's club championship and our women's club championship. And the weekend after that, we had our men's club championship. And 2 weeks after that, we had our fall member guest. So we kept it up there.
Whew. Oh. The poor membership at Carolina. Matthew Wharton is the course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club, our guest taking Dead Aim. After it was all said and done, feedback from the USGA, were they pleased? Is there a chance of Carolina getting to host other events?
I think the opportunity exists if the club chooses to go down that path. I think all the feedback we've gotten, both from participants as well as the USGA, was extremely positive. It has been an extremely rewarding experience to go through. And you know, back to my membership in the rough real quick, even throughout the summer, Charlie, they were, because our mowing height was a little bit taller than what we would normally keep here because of the tournament and what the USGA wanted, which even enhanced, if you will, the difficulty of the rough. And members would pass me and say, man, the rough is so thick or the rough is so difficult. But then their next sentence would be, I can't wait to see these guys have to deal with this. they didn't complain about the rough. They embraced it, and they were excited to see all these great players from around the country come and face the challenge. So it was really neat to be a part of.
Well, and in terms of hosting a major championship, and let's face it, if it gets you an invitation to the Masters, the Mid-Amateur is a major event. It's one of the least intrusive that you could have on your membership. It's not like your membership was kicked off the course for a month or anything. So I would think that the thrill of hosting, the cachet of hosting a USGA championship had to be somewhat appealing to your membership as well.
It definitely was. And, Charlie, the thing that blew me away was all the members that served as volunteers. We had about 150 of our own members that served as volunteers, whether it was with four caddies, stationary spotters, walking scores, hospitality, just greeting the players and providing assistance as they were on property. Parking, we ended up we could only park players at Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone was spectating or, you know, caddies or staff, we had off-site parking across the street at a local business, and we were running little shuttle vans, and all the folks doing all of that work were the members of Carolina Golf Club.
That is really amazing to me. I guess it shouldn't be because my experience with your membership over there has always been top-notch, but that does really somewhat surprise me.
It totally blew me away, and we just this past few weeks we had a little function to kind of say thank you to those volunteers, and we had a little reception at the club, and I raised my hand and I told them, I said, when you see the people that employ you give their time, their energy, and their effort with such enthusiasm, I said I was just in awe of you folks, and I could never have been more proud to be affiliated with Carolina Golf Club.
Matthew Wharton is the course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club. Our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Talk about a couple of things to get you out of here. We had to deal with a couple of unique situations this year, specifically Hurricane Florence, and then had another hurricane bark up our back door as well. What sort of damage was done to Carolina, and what are your challenges when you come out and see that damage? Can it be overwhelming, or did you know where to start? What did you see?
Well, we'll start with Florence. And, you know, ironically, the timing of Florence was Florence arrived in Charlotte exactly 1 week to the day before the U.S. Mid-Amateur started. So, thankfully, we knew Florence was coming. Ironically, the forecast changed midweek. A week before tournament week, we're looking at the forecast, and at that point, you know, Florence is unfortunately expected to hit around Wilmington and stay east of here. And then about 2 days later, the forecast changes, and they're like, no, it's going to make landfall at Wilmington, then do this funny little move,
yeah,
and kind of go down south and loop back around and come up through Charlotte. And we quickly made some adjustments. One of the things we did here was we went out with a growth regulator application on our tees and fairways and closely mown areas because, again, at this point in time, we didn't know how much rain we were going to get. We didn't know how long it was going to rain for, and we didn't know how that was going to impact our mowing schedule. So we went out with made a growth regulator application to slow down the rate of growth in case we, you know, couldn't get out there for a few days. Prior to the storm, you know, we were making sure that our storm drain inlets were clear. We just wanted to be able to get the water off the property as quickly as we could. And we did a little light top dressing on the greens, and we made a wetting agent application to the greens, again, to help move water. Storm lasted for two whole days. Golf course took it way better than I ever could have imagined. And on Monday morning, we're dealing with a lot of small debris.
Right.
Just, you know, just sticks and leaves and pine needles and pine cones and all that little stuff that's just a nuisance. We had one full-size pine tree on the right side of the fifth fairway that snapped off several feet above ground level that we had to cut up and remove. There was like a portion of another tree. So, I mean, in terms of tree damage, we were very lucky. Just a lot of debris that had to be cleaned up. I had a couple of members that showed up unexpectedly to help out. Just said, hey, we're here to help. What can we do to help? And we were closed all day that Monday cleaning up the golf course. And then we were also closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Practice rounds started on Thursday. And so we were mowing by Tuesday, believe it or not.
Well, it doesn't surprise me about your membership showing to help clean up. You give rednecks a chance to break out their chainsaws, they're going to take the opportunity to break out their chainsaws. Matthew, get you out of here with this one. We've moved into a completely different season now as we are recording this. We've had a very hard freeze. Bermuda has gone dormant everywhere. Bent grass, which is the grass that you have on your greens, tends to thrive a little bit when it gets cool and colder. You don't have some of the nightmare situations that Bermuda grass greens do. What sort of things are you doing with the golf course now? Is it an easier time of year for you, or just different challenges?
It's different challenges. I mean, still right now, we're kind of in the middle of what we call leaf season. I think you and everybody else in the Charlotte area, whether you play golf or just a homeowner, we're all still fighting that daily battle. So we're just trying to keep the golf course as clean as possible and as playable as we can. Yes, you're right. Our bent grass greens, we're not too stressed about them this time of year. Those guys with the Ultra Dwarf Bermudas, they may very well already be contemplating whether or not to cover. Considering how low the temperature got last night, it wouldn't surprise me if some of them had covered last night.
Right.
You know, and the thing with the covers is it's insurance, Charlie. You know, yeah, it can be a little bit of a nuisance. It's time consuming for one, and a little bit labor intensive. And heaven help those guys if they're trying to do it in the wind. But you know, protecting that turf, protecting that, you know, Bermuda grass is a warm season grass. Yes, it goes dormant, but it's subject to injury in extreme cold temperatures. So that covers just a little insulating layer, a little blanket, if you will, can help protect that plant and help it survive the winter. And I like to think of it as, you know, covers are to ultra dwarf Bermuda like fans are for bent grass. You know, in our summer months when the temperature's at its hottest and it's the most humid.
Right.
We have fans around half the greens here at Carolina to help with air movement and circulation. So it's that time of year, different challenges.
Not only is he great at what he does, he's a great guy too. Matthew Wharton, course superintendent at Carolina Golf Club. And when we return, Ryan Ballingy of thegolfnewsnet.com takes dead aim at the upcoming season with his 10 predictive question survey presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ryan Ballingy is the brains and the brawn behind thegolfnewsnet.com and joins us now to answer 10 predictive questions about the upcoming golf season. Ryan, last year, this question number one was this, over under major appearances by Tiger Woods, and I set the number at 1.5. I'm sort of modifying it this year. Over under tournament wins, regular tournament wins by Tiger Woods, and I'm again setting the number at 1.5.
I was going to say 2. I feel like 2 is a really good number. I think he can win a regular event. I mean, he's going to qualify for enough limited field events that if he chooses to play them, he should win at least 2 of them. He's just playing that well. I mean, he is the 13th, 14th ranked golfer in the world for a reason. And if he wasn't penalized by the way the official world golf ranking formula works, he'd be top 5 in the world right now. So I think that's an indication of how well he played this year. And he's going to get back into that kind of form of a schedule, playing the places he's used to playing, that he's won at a zillion times, and that's why he plays them. And I have a feeling he'll probably pick off a couple of out of that. So I like over that.
This is one of my favorite Vegas-like prop bet questions. More likely to happen, Rory and or Spieth complete the career Grand Slam this year, or neither ever completes it?
It's hard for me to say Jordan Spieth is never going to win a PGA Championship. I can understand why Rory's never going to win the Masters. It's just in his head. But Spieth, I think, could win a PGA Championship in the next couple of years. I think his window to win majors is shorter than everyone else's at kind of this level of the game for a variety of reasons. But at the same time, the PGA Championship is precisely the kind of golf that Jordan Spieth stinks at compared to his longer, more dominating peers, because it's basically a PGA Tour event. And if right. You think about the things that Spieth has won, they're anything but. They're difficult events to win. They require a lot of control, a lot of focus, a lot of kind of, there's no cruise control in those events where he won. Even when he won the Masters by a zillion, there was still a lot of concentration and grinding down to the very last moment. So I think that one day we will see one of those two break through, either Rory through dumb luck at Augusta, or Spieth will one day figure out how to win a PGA Championship.
I think this year, if one was going to complete it this year, I like Spieth's chances for this reason. Bethpage Black is not an easy course, even when it's set up to be easy. And so that may be the kind of grinding test for a PGA that he might excel in.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah, every once in a while you get one of those PGAs where the winning score is like 8 under instead of 20 under. And obviously an exaggeration, like 10, 12, 15 right. under kind of tends to win the PGA. But every once in a while you get a single digit score and you get some really interesting leaderboards in the PGA when that happens. So and I think about back to 2005, the PGA at Baltusrol. Obviously it was weather plagued, a lot of other issues with that, but the winning score was hovering around par. And that was one of the most interesting PGA leaderboards of the last 20 years. So maybe this one coming up, because it is Bethpage and it's difficulty, maybe that is the chance for Spieth to strike.
Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com is our guest, taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming golf season. Last year, I asked if Justin Thomas and Brooks Koepka were more likely to build off their major championship success or have that chasing appearance fees hangover that we see so often. Both had really good years. Brooks, a great one. Will both, either or neither, win a major this year?
I think Brooks is a threat to win any of the next 12 majors. I mean, so long as he doesn't kind of lose his way here, he can win. I mean, he's improved in every start he's had in the Masters in terms of his finish. Obviously, he didn't play it this year, so he couldn't have improved. But the ones he's made, he's always gotten better, and he's gotten closer to the top of the leaderboard. So he's figuring out how to play Augusta National. The U.S. Open is clearly his thing. He's a threat to win pretty much every U.S. Open until he stops hitting at 375 yards off the tee. I think the Open Championship is going to be a test for him, but he has also done extremely well at events in the European Tour, like Dunhill Links Championship, which is played at St. Andrews and King's Barnes
and Carnoustie. Yeah.
So he knows how to play that style of golf, too. Maybe just get the right week, right draw. And the PGA, like we talked about, is going to be kind of a more closely aligned to a U.S. Open type setup this year. I think it will take us some time to figure out how well guys make the adjustment to playing the PGA in May as opposed to August. So I think Brooks is going to win a major next year. I have no reason to believe he can't. And given the way that he performed in the U.S. Open against really a more popular Dustin Johnson, and certainly against a way more popular Tiger Woods on Sunday at Belrive, I don't think anything really fazes the guy.
Let's talk about these major championship venues: Augusta, Bethpage Black, Pebble Beach, and sort of the wild card, Royal Portrush. Do you think that these venues, are we more likely to see players padding their major championship resumes or first-time winners?
I don't know. I mean, I think the Masters tends to produce guys that are going to win the Masters, or at least threaten to win the Masters a couple of times, and probably will be a multi-time major champion. So put that aside, maybe. But think about the guys who have won the U.S. Open at Pebble the last few times. Now, other than Tiger, you know, in 2000, which was the peak, the literal peak of his powers.
Right.
Think about the two guys that won before and after him. Tom Kite, who broke an 0-4, I think, 72 skid in the majors, winning his one and only major. And then Graham McDowell, who won his one and only major at Pebble. So I think that invites itself, for as much as we love Pebble and have had other great iconic results and champions there, having a first-time winner. Bethpage, maybe not as... I mean, Bethpage is kind of interesting, too, in that we don't really know how it's going to play in May. So I think that's potentially possible. And then Portrush, for as amazing as it is, and that it's going to be a world-class golf course, and hopefully will become a regular part of the Open rotation. Not many guys have played it competitively, and they certainly haven't played all 18 of the existing holes because they put two new ones in competitively.
Right.
So I think we do have the potential for a lot of first-time major winners next year.
Cameron Champ fascinates me this first part of the wraparound season. He just won his first tour event. Guy kills it. However, in his win, he averaged 324 off the tee, but he was near last in the field in fairways hit, third in greens hit. Ryan, my question to you is this what's wrong with the game, or is this just where the game is and there's nothing we can do about it?
I think it's more what's wrong with at least the professional game. And I want to be very explicit to say professional, high-level amateur game, because it's so often made the case on Twitter or social media arguments about technology and technology's potential negative impact on the sport, and everyone kind of clumps it all together. But, you know, we talk about the ball being too far, and then the people who combat that argument say, well, you know, I don't hit it too far. I still hit it 227 like I did in 1988. And you go, we don't mean you. We mean guys like Cameron Champ or Norman Jean or guys who are coming up who swing from 125 to nearly 130 miles per hour with the driver, who are going to pound the ball into orbit if we don't stop the golf ball. And the really intriguing thing about this with Cameron Champ and those stats that you're laying out, it's kind of similar to what Vijay Singh figured out when he had his nine-win season, which was, I don't need to hit the fairway to win. I just need to hit it far and not behind a tree to win. And he realized, by hitting it farther and not minding being in the fairly light, rough setup of most PGA Tour events, he could still hit greens. He would hit shorter clubs in. He would put enough spin on it. And if he just made enough putts, which is basically Cameron Champ's problem too, then he would win. He would do really well. And so I think that has kind of come full circle. And now you've got these younger guys who aren't afraid to miss fairways because what difference does it make if wedge is in their hand from an inch and a half deep rough to, one-eighth inch cut from the fairway? Not much. And so I think that's going to change the professional game, and really has changed to an extent, to allow these guys who are longer hitters to be winners more frequently. But the rub here on the PGA Tour, and really has been for the last 10 or 12 years, is every guy is kind of capable of winning. The longer guys have the advantage out the gate, but whoever putts the best in the end of the week wins. And when Cameron Champ won at the Sanderson Farms, it was because he putted out of his mind,
right?
Despite all of the ball striking inaccuracy off the tee. So you got to be able to putt well, no matter what anyone says about ball striking to the green. That just sets you up for the capacity to win, but the putts have to fall to make it happen.
You're not the first one to make the Cameron Champ Vijay Singh comparison. It's an apt one. Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com, our guest taking Dead Aim. 10 predictive questions for the upcoming season. Bryson DeChambeau, Ricky Fowler, and John Rahm. These are the only three players that are currently in the top 10 in the world who have not won a major. Who wins one first? Will it be this year? And if I threw in number 11 in the mix, Tommy Fleetwood, does that make a difference?
Maybe. I'm a huge fan of Fleetwood's game, and I think he could win. I thought he was going to win a major this year, to be truthful with you. I'm kind of surprised that he didn't. And I think that I would even throw in Tony Finau. I thought he was due for a major this year, too, after the way he kind of went through it all and got close, just didn't get it done in the end. But I think of the three guys you initially mentioned, Bryson just seems to be on this roll. He has figured out how to do the PGA Tour for him. And whether that lasts long term is a huge question mark. I mean, I think the quote that is always kind of tweeted out by Robert Lucetich, that he talked to some college coach who said, either Bryson's going to be a straitjacket in 5 years or he's going to be number one in the world. I think that's really apt. I think he could drive himself to madness in this game, but right now he is in his zone and he has figured out how to win, and it doesn't seem to really bother him when he gets kind of in the nitty-gritty of it. At Memorial, he could have lost that three different times, and he figured out a way to get by Ben on and win in the playoff. And in Vegas, things started to get close. Patrick Cantlay was getting closer. He didn't care. He just closed it out. He knew he had the advantage. So I think he knows how to win better than the other two guys. And I think Rahm's emotions get the best of him too frequently. And at this point, I feel like he's put almost too much pressure on himself because everyone saw how well he came out the gate and figured, okay, well, you're just going to take the natural leap like Spieth did to winning multiple majors. That hasn't happened yet. And so I think he's starting to put pressure on himself. Fowler, on the other hand, I think the day he realizes he can stop caring about winning majors is when he's going to win one. It'll kind of be like the Phil situation. I think Ricky Fowler is very much like Phil Mickelson in that regard. Not as prolific of a winner, but when Phil realized he could come from behind to win a major and then did it at the 04 Masters, I think that changed how he felt about himself. And I think Ricky Fowler kind of has to have the same thing happen to him, where he has a great Sunday and someone's just not good enough. Don't have to fall apart, just not good enough. They let him in the door. Then I think he can win a major. But I don't think that's 2019.
Ryan, one of my favorite annual questions here. Yes or no, do you think the USGA finds a way to screw up the setup at Pebble and make themselves the story once again at the U.S. Open?
Yeah. That's the shtick of the U.S. Open now, is how will the USGA screw this up? It just is.
It's not a question of if, it's a question of how.
It's how. I mean, this year was they lost the greens on Saturday. In 2017, it was it's too easy, it's too wide. And that was some bad luck on their part. In 2016, actually, it was pretty well received, I thought. 2015, they made a horrible choice in conditioning, course conditioning, and setup at Chambers. In 2014 at Pinehurst, it was just bad luck of the draw. Marty Keimer just slayed everybody. They made Marion way too narrow and short, like the Tom Meeks era, just to keep it competitive under 7,000 yards. You kind of go down the line. So, like, every 3 or 4 years, they get a good one. Olympic Club was fair, which is really hard. And then 2016 at Oakmont was fair. So we're at 2019, which means it's not an even-numbered year, and it's not a number divisible by four. So probably going to be a screw-up of some kind. I'm really curious, and I mean this genuinely, how the USGA will figure out how to play 14. It was a thorn in their side in 92 and 2000 and 2010, and they've redesigned the hole as best they can, but I don't know how it's going to work in the national championship in June, and I don't know if it's going to be a big source of frustration or not. So that's where I start looking at how this could go sideways for the USGA next year at Pebble.
Ryan, Billy Payne's going into the Hall of Fame for his work primarily in growing the game in the last 10 years as chairman of, at Augusta National. However, unlike previous chairman, made really no significant changes to the golf course. Didn't want that to be part of his legacy. How much change and how fast do you think we get them with a player's chairman like Fred Ridley? And do you think there's any chance of rolling back some of the Hootie changes that everybody hated?
That's really interesting. I think Fred Ridley has a huge opportunity in front of him to do or undo the right thing at Augusta National. And you're right. Billy Payne spent his entire tenure basically elevating Augusta National Golf Club in the Masters Tournament to their seat at the table as a quasi-governing body of golf,
which is
what they did with the Latin American Amateur, the Asia-Pacific Amateur. They've done those kinds of drive, chip, and putt. He did those kinds of things to position Augusta National to the point where they were at the same table as the PGA of America, USGA, and RNA, and they were equal, if not more important than them. And that work's been done, and everyone's kind of cool with it right now. So Fred Ridley doesn't have to worry about that. He can just, although they did obviously have made a big thing with the Augusta Women's Amateur, which I think is awesome as well. But what Fred Ridley can focus on is making the Masters Tournament experience as good as possible and Augusta National Golf Club as good as possible. Number five has kind of got to be changed as the product of technology. They're going to do that. I think then from there, he has to start thinking about how am I going to change 13, if at all, to account for technology. They obviously acquired the property at Augusta Country Club to be able to do that. And then do you start thinking about undoing some of the things Hootie did, fixing 10, 11, come to mind immediately. There are things that could be done. And I don't think that anyone would kind of blink. I would like 18 to be a little bit more wide out the chute. There's some stuff there that I think plenty of people would get on board with. Some are obvious, some are not. But I think that's what Ridley's mission is for however long his tenure will be. Get the golf course back to where it needs to be. Don't make it as much of a kind of PGA Tour style course that just is the best playground on earth. Make it a little bit more like Augusta National was originally intended to be.
You mentioned Tony Finau earlier. There's Tony Finau. There's a bunch of young players. We mentioned Cameron Champ, Sam Burns, Austin Cook. Is there a player bubbling under the surface kind of the media watchful eye that you have your eye on this year that you think is going to take that next step, either a Finau from a guy who can win on tour to a guy who can win a major, or one of these young guys going to become a regular winner?
I mean, Finau is kind of obviously the standout, right? I mean, he was top 10 in the first three majors of the year, and like, okay, well, he's got to get one of these. I mean, he's just too good. He's improved his game in so many different ways over the last 24 months that he is just soundly a better player. And it just seems like he's going to get there. I think Patrick Cantlay does fly under the radar tremendously so. I mean, his comeback has been amazingly successful in really the same vein as Tiger Woods. I mean, it's kind of similar. They're 20 years different, but Patrick came back from this horrible car wreck, killed his pedestrians and that killed his best friend right in front of his eyes. He's had all of these back and neck problems that have somehow gotten better just by weighing them out. He went from hardly any status to winning to get into the top 20 in the world. He is one of the most consistent players in the world right now. I think he's underappreciated for what he's been able to accomplish. And I love Cameron Smith's game. I love the way he looks and plays. He just has not put it together on a big stage yet, but he got close to the Masters. He gave himself a good run there. He's starting to figure out how to kind of do this a little bit more frequently. So I think he's someone that kind of flies under the radar and could be special. And then I love Eddie Pepperell. I don't know if he's ever going to win a major championship. Maybe that's a little bit too big for him. But I love what he's managed to do to come back from the absolute gutter of the game, thinking it's not worth it and he's going to quit, to he's 38th in the world. So he's come a long way in a short period of time on the European tour. Maybe if he can transition that to the U.S., I think he would be captivating.
Get you out of here on this. Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com, our guest taking Dead Aim. Your gut or surprise prediction about anything in the world of golf this next year?
Wow. I mean, that's so much stuff. I think the internationals are going to win the President's Cup.
Wow!
I just think Ernie Els is on to something, and Nick Price was. Nick Price was on to something, and they almost delivered for him in South Korea in 2015. He got the rules of the competition changed to slightly favor the internationals, that they could hide more players. And I think that Nick Price has communicated to Ernie Els a lot of the foibles that go along with running this team that speaks like five different languages and never otherwise gets together. Ernie Els knows what has to be done, and I think it actually kind of symbolically began by creating a new team logo. They've lost for 20-plus years using that stinking circle of stars. Now they actually have a real logo they can kind of rally around, and that this message is, we can win, and we can win at Royal Melbourne. It's a great match play golf course. They can prepare for it. The team will probably be loaded with Aussies who know how to play it. I think they'll win.
From thegolfnewsnet.com, that's Ryan Ballingy. I'd also like to thank Carolina Golf Club course super Matthew Wharton and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. Hey, reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Currently featured there, articles on all aspects of the match and a video from Dustin Johnson that I guarantee will make you feel better about your own mishits on the range. And weather-wise, Sunday better than Saturday to let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground this weekend, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.